Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 16th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's first article, top of the fold, Peace Buy Startles Seaboard Station Shops by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Seaboard Station's Ace Hardware owner Bob King is finding out the hard way that bankers don't like uncertainty. King says it was shortly after the leaders of neighboring William Peace University announced their plans to acquire the shops at Seaboard Station Retail Center on the northern edge of downtown Raleigh that he was turned down for a deal to refinance his business loan with SunTrust Bank. They wouldn't do it because the bankers know what's going on here, King says, referring to the university's pending deal to buy the retail property out of bankruptcy. Peace University leaders have said there are no immediate plans to change the use of the retail property, which has undergone a complete redevelopment in 2006 from warehouse into retail space, but King says there's no certainty that the university's plans won't change once the sale is finalized this fall. If I only have 9 years left on my lease, I've got a $3 million business I can't sell, he says. The tenants are concerned. All of us have put our lives and fortunes into this shopping center. The only statement that the university has issued since a bankruptcy court judge approved the $21 million sale of Seaboard Station is that it is committed to the local community, and should we acquire the property, we would work with the community in a positive way to enhance its value to the city and beyond. We are committed to our neighbors and want the area to be the best place to live, work, and go to school. Peace University President Deborah Townsley was not available for a further comment. Liberty University Chancellor Jerry Falwell Jr. says he faced similar criticism in 2010 when his university acquired a 270,000-square-foot shopping center that's anchored by Toys R Us, TJ Maxx, and several other national and regional retailers adjacent to Liberty's campus in Lynchburg, Virginia. This was done as an investment, but also because of its strategic location, he says. Even if we did start to lose tenants in the future, it could be converted to university use. Either way, it's a win for the university. Falwell says the Candler's Station Shopping Center in Lynchburg has stayed fairly well leased since the acquisition, and he estimates that the university's endowment is getting 13-14% in returns each year from the property's rental income. But Liberty University also has plenty of other land options for expansion of its campus, and converting the shopping center into classrooms or dormitories would be a last resort. Peace University, however, is mostly landlocked at its location on Peace Street, and it has been working to grow its student population. George York, president of York Properties in Raleigh, which recently completed the renovation of a standalone retail building near the entrance to Seaboard Station, says he knows of several investor groups that tried to put together an offer for the Seaboard Station property, but none could beat the $21 million offer made by Peace. We'll be interested to see what happens there as well, he says. Almost all of the tenants at Seaboard are locally owned businesses and restaurants, like the popular 18 Seaboard restaurant, Tyler's Taproom Bar and Grill, the Fido Pet Store, and apparel boutique Galatea. Michael Oleander Jr., CEO and owner of the O2 Fitness chain of gyms, says he leases more space at Seaboard Station than any other tenant at the center, but he says he has not yet had any communication with the university's leaders who could become his new landlord. That's a great location. It serves downtown Raleigh well. It serves the Peace campus well. But I'm concerned they haven't even tried to reach out to their largest tenant yet, Oleander says. King says he feels confident that Peace University will honor the terms of his lease contract that he negotiated with the current owners of the property 6 years ago. But he's worried that if the university decides not to renew the lease terms of his retail neighbors, he'll lose nearly half of his customer base. About 40% of our business is impulse shoppers, he says. It's the folks going over to Logan's to buy flowers and then stopping by the store because it's there. If you take that 40% away, I'm out of business. Next up, this week's lead article, Will They Come? After spending more than $600 million on airport expansion, RDU officials wait for returns. By Chris Bagley. This article is from Morrisville. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is at a major pivot point. The new $570 million Terminal 2 opened in stages from 2008 to early 2011, and the airport barely paused for breath before launching into a $68 million renovation of Terminal 1 in summer 2012. The renovated section of Terminal 1 is expected to open in March. Now, having put some $650 million into capital improvements over the last half decade, RDU is beginning to shift its focus squarely onto operations and routine maintenance. Airport Director Michael Langeth estimates that maintenance over the next 5 years is, in comparison, will require only about $150 million from RDU's capital budget. We now have a lot of the infrastructure in place to support the growth for the next 20 to 25 years, Langeth said in an August 13 interview. The focus is crucial because growth doesn't come easily anymore. The quickly consolidating airline industry, which was scrambling to fill planes as recently as 2010, is now flexing its muscles in negotiations with airports. Virtually across the board, airlines are cutting capacity to reduce the number of empty seats, and they haven't hesitated to cut flights from numerous routes. About 180 flights depart from RDU each day, on average, down 10% from the 200 or so that were taking off just a couple of years ago. While passenger numbers at RDU haven't fallen, they haven't risen either. On a summer evening in August at 8:30 p.m., passengers flying into RDU would have seen a mostly vacant Terminal 2 with several of the gates on one side near darkness. One thing for sure, the problem is not capacity for the airport. The problem is what carriers are doing with their business model and whether it will fit into RDU's $650 million upgrade. The issue is, how do you recover all that investment? Airline analyst Bob Mann of R.W. Mann & Company says of the terminal's cost. For RDU and most other airports, the answer has been to rely on revenue that isn't tied to numbers of takeoffs and landings. RDU has recently raised parking rates and is enticing passengers to spend more at shops and restaurants in the new terminals. The airport takes 10 to 15% of the purchases, in addition to annual lease payments. As for relying on parking fees, if the Triangle ever had a transit system that ran through the airport, even North Carolina Department of Transportation Secretary Anthony Tata admits that transit service could compete for dollars out of RDU's parking revenue pot. We need to take a closer look at that at the appropriate time, Tata says. But airport officials are not sitting back and waiting for things to happen. RDU created a new position specifically to manage air service, including RDU's dealings with airlines last fall. It's entering its second year under a new air service policy that gives up to $350,000 in fee breaks to airlines that begin service to priority destinations on the West Coast and in Europe. The policy has already helped to speed executives from San Francisco, Silicon Valley, and Los Angeles to potential investment sites in the Triangle. While the airport's board hasn't authorized breaks for further domestic destinations, Langeth says it's conceivable that he could go back and ask it to consider incentives for a nonstop flight to a destination in the Pacific Northwest. Either way, people in the Triangle's travel industry says they wouldn't be surprised to see a nonstop flight to Seattle in the next couple of years. And the policy still provides incentives for nonstops to Paris or Frankfurt, Germany. But the air service policy also entails hundreds of thousands of dollars in foregone revenue, which the airport is hustling to recoup on the ground via parking, restaurants, and the like. Industry analysts who follow RDU say the airport is doing a good job of meeting the daunting challenges that airports face. Moreover, they say its balance sheet is solid and it benefits from a growing population, and particularly from the large amount of relatively lucrative business travel between major locations in the Research Triangle Park and corporate headquarters elsewhere. Fitch Ratings analyst Chris Johansson cited several of those factors in June when he affirmed the agency's AA rating on nearly $750 million in RDU revenue bonds. RDU, quote, continues to maintain a stable cost structure, quote, Johansson wrote. The airport's average cost per enplanement is a relative low $6.46, he wrote. Independent airport consultant Bill Fife praises RDU on several fronts, including the cost structure and what he says are RDU's leaders continuing efforts to adopt best practices from other airports. A lot of that goes back to a governance structure that fosters long-term planning, he says. Its 8 board members come from Raleigh, Durham, Wake County, and Durham County. In contrast to airport boards that are controlled by single city or county governments, RDUs can focus on long-term planning instead of the next election, Fife says. Meanwhile, people in the Triangle's travel industry say they expect to see a few more new routes at RDU in the next couple of years. Veteran travel agent Tony Maupin of Maupin Travel says the mid-sized wide-body jets and large regional jets replacing large wide-bodies have allowed airlines to add routes with relatively little risk. In the last year, airlines have added routes from RDU to San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Trenton, New Jersey. Delta Airlines is preparing to add a route to Salt Lake City. We've added a few more points on the map, which has really gotten some interest from the local business community, Langeth says. A side note to this article, Raleigh-Durham International Airport has seen some big changes in the last few years, and more are expected in the next few. Here's a timeline. 2006, construction begins at RDU's Terminal 2. October 2008, the first phase of Terminal 2 opens. January 2011, Terminal 2 is completely open. The entire project costs $570 million. November 2011, longtime airport director John Brantley retires. Michael Langeth arrives from Chattanooga's airport to succeed Brantley. May 2012, a new policy at RDU offers up to $350,000 in free landing fees and marketing support for airlines that connect RDU with hotly sought destinations on the West Coast and in Europe. July 2012, crews begin a renovation of Terminal 1 that's expected to cost $68 million and take at least 18 months. August 2012, United Airlines launches a daily flight from RDU to San Francisco, the first ever and the first regular nonstop flight to Northern California in a decade. It's also the first flight to take advantage of the new air service policy. Moving inside this week's cover, Novello Buy offers Quintiles Revenue Diversity by Lauren K. Onisorge. Deals are happening in the Triangle Contract Research Organization space, and they're attracting global attention. Last year, Novello Clinical CEO Richard Staub said his company's growth strategy was simple: continued organic growth coupled with strategic acquisitions. It's a formula that had allowed his company to grow locally from 80 employees in 2005 to more than 300 by the time it moved into its new 77,000-square-foot headquarters in Morrisville in January. On August 14th, however, the Morrisville company became the acquired, snagged in a landmark acquisition by contract research organization Mammoth Quintiles. It's the first big deal for Quintiles since the company raised nearly $950 million in an initial public offering in May. While neither company will comment on financial details, Quintiles spokesperson Phil Bridges does say the deal is a strategic move aimed at bolstering what's already in place for the newly public company. This acquisition is in alignment with Quintiles' core clinical development growth strategy, he says, adding that it allows Quintiles to snag two very distinct customer groups: emerging oncology customers and biomedical devices. Quintiles has a good bit of oncology experience and expertise, Bridges says, referencing the more than 900 oncology trials his company has supported over the past decade. Novella, however, adds a significant emerging growth customer base. That will enable us to extend and differentiate capabilities among the emerging oncology customer segment. And when the other distinct customer group we're talking about, where this will really help us, is the medical device and diagnostic customers. Novella's dominance in that second sector will help Quintiles solidify its position within the medical and diagnostic services market, Bridges says. As far as the transition itself, Bridges maintains confidence that no Novella jobs will be lost. While it's impossible to predict the future, no reductions from this transaction are planned at this time, he reiterates, adding that the personnel helped drive the decision to acquire Novella. Novella Clinical will operate as an independent subsidiary, still led by Staub. Staub, however, will now report to Paula Brown Stafford, president of clinical development at Quintiles. Via a prepared statement, Stafford called the company a strong addition to Quintiles' existing capabilities and one that will help further differentiate the company in a competitive marketplace. Quintiles has 2,100 employees in Durham and 2,300 statewide, and 27,000 employees worldwide. The company reported $3.7 billion in revenue in 2012. Novella, which has more than 800 employees in North America and Europe, had more than $100 million in revenue by 2011. The deal should close later this quarter, but exactly how it will impact Quintiles remains to be seen. Fred Eshelman, former CEO of another CRO giant, PPD, didn't have any inside details or opinions to share, but did offer an emailed observation when asked for comment on Wednesday. Quote, I will say that when I was at PPD, after we had size and scope, we did not buy more of the same, but only were interested in expansion into new revenue areas, picking up needed skills, or perhaps a different set of clients. End quote. Moving on to commercial and residential real estate, Amanda Hoyle has written an article called Property Matters, a roundup of top real estate deals in recent weeks. On August 14th, the State Department of Health and Human Services closed out a second round of bids from local landlords pitching plans for a consolidated 83,618-square-foot home office for the NC FAST case management program. State officials say they had underestimated their space needs in June when they issued a request for proposals for about 72,000 square feet of office space. Neil Coker's Pinnacle Park 3 building in Durham had been the front runner in the deal, but Coker says his building is now disqualified because of the adjusted bid requirements. NC FAST had also underestimated its needs when it first opened in about 30,000 square feet at the Glenwood Place Office Park in Raleigh. The program now employs 410 people, more than twice the number of employees the office was supposed to accommodate. Also, New York real estate firm Cary Watermark Investors finalized its purchase of the Marriott City Center Hotel in downtown Raleigh on August 14th for $83 million, about $222,500 per room after the investment of an additional $6 million in planned improvements to the 17-story building. The Raleigh City Council had given its blessing to the deal a few weeks ago, since the hotel had been built with the help of $20 million in public money. County taxpayers, however, will not benefit from the profits of the sale, since the tax proceeds were given as a grant in exchange for a promise to hold hotel rooms open for bookings at the attached Raleigh Convention Center. Despite its less-than-rosy earnings report on August 13th, Cree Incorporated is planning for its future and has purchased another office building for future expansion near its Durham headquarters. Cree paid a discounted $1.84 million for the 86,000-square-foot Pinnacle Park II building at 4401 Silicon Drive. The building, which is near Cree's corporate office building, also on Silicon Drive, has been empty since IBM and Lenovo vacated the property several years ago. Continuing on under Amanda Hoyle's column for commercial and real estate, a submarket at a glance, RTP holds occupancy steady. Among the 15 commercial real estate submarkets tracked in the Triangle Business Journal's quarterly space survey, The Research Triangle Park and I-40 submarket is by far the largest, with more than 29 million square feet of office, flex, warehouse, and retail space that's listed as available for lease. Here's a snapshot of how the RTP I-40 submarket fared in the third quarter of 2013 compared to the year prior. The type of space is office. The leasable square foot is 11.1 million. The second quarter 12 vacancy percent is 23, and the second quarter 13 vacancy percent is 23.4. That's an increase of 0.4%. Type of space for flex and leasable square foot at 6.2 million. Second quarter 12 vacancy percent is 15.5, and second quarter 13 vacancy percent is 18.4. That's a 3.1% increase. The type of space is warehouse, and leasable square foot is 10.9 million square feet. Second quarter 12 vacancy percent is 10.9, and second quarter 13 vacancy percent is 7.9. That is a drop in 3%. With a retail type of space, and the leasable square footage is 1.2 million square feet, second quarter vacancy was 21.7%. Second quarter 13 vacancy is 20.1%. That's a drop in 0.6%. Next up, Jason DeBruin, who covers healthcare, nonprofits, and sports business, writes an article, UNC System Looking at Deeper Cuts. Cuts from state taxpayers to the University of North Carolina system have been the norm in the past few years, and 2013-14 school year is no different. State lawmakers in the General Assembly reduced the UNC system budget from $2.58 billion last year to $2.51 billion this year and budgeted $2.49 billion for 2014-15. The UNC Board of Governors takes the overall budget and divvies it up to the 17 institutions. Board member Hannah Gage said that the cuts this year don't seem so bad, but that the cumulative effect is taking its toll on the overall system. In 2010-11, which included federal stimulus funds, it received $2.7 billion. System President Tom Ross echoed Gage's thoughts and referred back to the $414 million in cuts the system had to absorb in just one year. Students will face a tuition increase this year, but university students and their parents heard some welcome news when Ross said he would recommend that tuition not be increased for North Carolina residents next year. Of course, that must still be approved by the Board of Governors and ultimately the General Assembly, but the news was no doubt welcomed by students and parents. Tuition and fees have been increasing steadily throughout North Carolina's public universities. For the upcoming year, for example, in-state students attending NC State or UNC Chapel Hill will pay roughly $8,100 this year. As recently as 2009 and 10 school year, tuition at UNCCH and NCSU was in the $5,500 range. In 2002 and 3, tuition at both universities was less than $4,000 per year. In North Carolina, the General Assembly assigns an overall budget to the UNC system. The UNC Board of Governors then divvies up that money to each university. What follows is a series of quotes from the movers and shakers in the UNC system. Mr. Tom Ross, president of the UNC system, is quoted as saying, "It's a real cut that will be added to the medical school." His comment is to the General Assembly on reducing from $15 million to zero the appropriation of the UNC School of Medicine. In 2008, the appropriation was $47 million. UNC Chapel Hill Chancellor Carol Folt says that she and UNC Chapel Hill will work through the budget cuts, and she's quoted as saying, "The truth is, we will do what needs to be done. We have to increase efficiency. We have to push up our sleeves and work together." Hannah Gage, a member of the UNC Board of Governors, on the budget cuts this year and the cumulative effect, is quoted as saying, "This is a fifth year of cuts. These look doable, but it's year after year after year." And the UNC System Chief Operating Officer, Charlie Pierce, giving an overall view of the budget cuts handed down to the UNC System from the General Assembly, is quoted as saying, Overall, I think we ended up being better off than we anticipated, even just a few weeks before the conference process. And finally, Fred Eshelman, a member of the UNC Board of Governors on the budget cuts, particularly considering the budget does not include any of the $237 million in strategic plan initiatives requested and the cumulative cuts in the past 5 years. He's quoted as saying, "The fact of the matter is, we got decimated." This week's column from Lauren K. Onisorge covers infotech, biotechnology, and entrepreneurism. Her column this week is entitled, "Eco App Educates Tourists and Helps the Dolphins Sleep." A smartphone is no longer just a window into your social circle. It's a window to the world and a growing app category. The Eco App increasingly lets people feel like they're a part of the world, even when the subject of that interest is oceans away. In crystal water, thousands of miles to the west, for example, spinner dolphins are engaging in one of their most important activities, resting. But somewhere nearby, on a seemingly innocent day cruise, binoculared tourists are about to interrupt that tranquility by swimming, splashing, and ogling. "It's not totally the tourists' fault," says Dave Johnson, a researcher and assistant professor at the Nicholas School of the Environment at the Duke University Marine Laboratory. "They just don't know any better." That's where the Naya Guide comes in, an app developed by his team and funded by Dolphin Smart to promote responsible ecotourism, not the kind that harms the very creatures that the tourists claim to love. The app not only educates downloaders with videos and facts about the dolphins, it also helps them cater their vacations to be eco-friendlier. App users can search by island and find environmentally friendly options. For Johnston, who's been researching the dolphins in Hawaii for the past 4 years, it's not about capitalizing on the growing eco-app trend. It's about translating the science. "We want to take that information and give it in a way that could make it useful," he explains. Spinners aren't always the social creatures tourists have come to expect from flipper reruns. Flipper, you may recall, was a bottlenose dolphin, and spinners are much more particular. "They have this really, really rigid behavior schedule," he says. "Their food is only available to them at night, so they actually have to forage all night. They do it in the dark. They do it in a very coordinated way in groups, so they get tired. They transition from their foraging area and into some resting areas in the day. The trouble? Those resting areas are exactly where tourists like to go. And the dolphins are very vulnerable to disturbance." Demi Fox, the graduate student behind the app, says the implications are wider than just dolphins. "If it's successful, it can serve as a model for other ways to put science in the hands of other people," she says. Johnston says colleagues have already had conversations about the app, but academia isn't the only source of eco-apps. In California, the Monterey Bay Aquarium has developed its own app called Seafood Watch to give consumers a tool to explore which seafood is sustainable. Spokesperson Ken Peterson says the app, which has been downloaded more than a million times in iOS and Android, gives people a way to crowdsource sustainable seafood that they find in their travels as a resource for others who are looking for restaurants and retailers that offer sustainable seafood options. And Monterey has partnered with other apps such as SharkNet, which has real-time data about great white shark migrations, and JellyWatch, a citizen science tool for folks to share sightings of jelly blooms with researchers. "The citizen science trend isn't surprising," says app expert and developer Ed Holsworth, the founder of Durham-based Little Green Software. While his company doesn't create eco-apps, it's a trend he has witnessed and is not surprised by. "It's every industry, every interest, everything," he says. "There's a ton of interest in just mobile apps." And he's right. Apple's iOS has more than 900,000 apps, and Android has more than a million, and the numbers are growing, especially when you look outside the ocean at eco-apps as a whole, just as energy watchdog app Joulebug, also developed in Durham. Eco-apps are a rising, albeit niche, player. AptWatcher, AptAnnie, puts Expedition White Shark, developed by the Marine Conservation Science Institute, as the number 2 education paid app currently on the market. Games, however, still take up 75% of App Store revenues, and 80% of Google Play revenues, followed by social app downloads. And now, the spotlight on manufacturing. North Carolina continues to rely on manufacturing growth. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. America's manufacturing sector is showing signs of a resurgence. In July, the country's manufacturing sector grew slightly, making it a second month in a row this year. This is a sharp reversal of the trend in the past 10 years, when more than 2.5 million jobs were lost because of plant closures, liquidation, or work moving overseas. For North Carolina, the stakes are even higher. While the manufacturing sector was responsible for about 12% of the country's economic output in North Carolina, it is about 19.4%, making it the fourth highest in the nation. Also, the sector accounts for almost 11% of total jobs in the state. In 2012, chemical manufacturing accounted for almost 25% of the state's $84 billion manufacturing output, and another $20 billion came from the food, beverage, and tobacco product industry. Here's a look at the state's general economy and manufacturing sector by the numbers and the sector roles in the triangle economy. Manufactured goods as a share of total exports. South Carolina's is 91.8%, followed by North Carolina at 84.4%. Third in manufacturing goods as a share of total exports is Georgia with 83.8%, followed by Mississippi at 83.2%. Alabama is at 80.7%, and Tennessee drops into the 70s as manufactured goods as a share of total exports, 74.8%, followed by Virginia at 74.5%. Airports target concession revenues, by Chris Bagley, from Morrisville. Airports across the country are relying more heavily on non-aeronautical revenue than ever before. That trend began 20 years ago, but it has become particularly important in the last couple of years as airlines cut their capacity. About 10% fewer flights are taking off from Raleigh-Durham International Airport each day, on average, than were departing a couple of years ago, according to the RDU statistics, limiting the airport's revenue from landing fees. Airport analyst Bill Fife notes that such aeronautical revenue is tied more closely to passenger numbers than to number of flights, although higher fares are limiting those too. That puts a premium on airports' ability to bring in retailers and restaurants where passengers will be willing to spend their dollars, as well as their ability to draw taxi services and other services that can pay concessions. RDU and most other airports have been drawing greater portions of their revenue from such non-aeronautical resources in the last few years. The American Association of Airport Executives, the primary organization for airports, has even begun to hold regular conferences dedicated to non-aeronautical revenue. Industry studies have found that airports now earn as much as 46% of their revenue on the ground. The trend is particularly important for non-hub airports outside of premier locations, such as New York and Denver, says Richard Walls, director of the North Carolina Department of Transportation's Aviation Division. Next up, small business, Theater Consultants Collaborative. Stage-savvy designers boost performance hall aesthetics. This article is by Chris Bagley. Sound-dampening curtains can be drawn across the slide and back walls when the performance calls for less reverberation. The plush seats vary in width from 19 to 23 inches for a staggered layout that keeps audience members from blocking each other's views. The air conditioning seeps in through tens of thousands of quarter-inch holes in the wooden stage, thus dispensing with noisy HVAC ducts. Such are the touches that Theater Consultants Collaborative has brought to the newly renovated Baldwin Auditorium on Duke University's East Campus and several other projects each year. 10 years after its founding, the company is pulling in $1.1 million to $1.5 million in annual revenue, depending on the timing of projects. An architectural firm usually brings in TCC when it first bids a project and includes TCC's fee as part of the overall design bid. Some architects, including Pfeiffer Partners, the New York firm that designed Baldwin's renovation, have in-house expertise in theater design. Still, architects often bring in theater consultants to get the nuances right. Theater design firms with multiple consultants have added additional levels of expertise in the last couple of decades, says Josh Allen, the TCC partner who acted as project manager for the Baldwin project. A lot of times the architects will know what they want the building to look like, but they don't know what it takes to make it function like a theater, Allen says, sitting in Baldwin's renovated balcony on a recent Tuesday afternoon. TCC has worked on theaters throughout North America, plus a handful in Europe and the Middle East. Some, like Baldwin, are concert halls. Others are for drama performances. Still others are multipurpose. An especially heavy concentration is in the Triangle, where five of the company's 12 staffers live. The company's local projects include the Durham Performing Arts Center, UNC Chapel Hill's Memorial Hall, and Burning Coal Theater in Raleigh's Oakwood neighborhood. Baldwin is scheduled to reopen September 14th with a celebratory concert. A sixth TCCer is in Asheville, while three are in Toronto, two in New York, and one in the Los Angeles area. The company has an unusual ownership structure designed to protect the consultants from the liability that would result from, say, a stage light falling and injuring a performer. Each of its 10 consultants has formed a corporation, and each of those corporations owns a portion of the overall company. The consultants who work on a given project are paid by the client, with TCC taking a cut off the top to cover its overhead, including pay for the company's bookkeeper and marketer, Allen says. There's no headquarters, per se, just a Dropbox account for the extensive file sharing and a go-to meeting account for regular FaceTime. There's not much point in paying for office space when each of the 10 consultants is in the air for 50,000 miles every year, Allen says. That setup also helps to limit the overhead. It really gives us the ability to have a competitive edge, says Allen. Robert Long, Curtis Casefang, Ben Bolton formed the company in 2003. They'd worked together on numerous projects as individual consultants, but believed they could be more effective and profitable if they set up a company of their own. They brought on new partners as circumstances required until late 2007, when the company reached its current size. Each of the 10 has his own niche. A couple of them are trained architects. Several have backgrounds in music, others in theater, and still others in film. Allen has worked as an actor and has something of a specialty in lighting. The consultants usually work directly with the client, with the architecture firm, and in the case of concert halls, an acoustic consulting firm such as Jaffe Holden. Ray Walker, a Duke architect who helped oversee the Baldwin renovation, says it's notable that all four finalist architecture firms bidding for the project had chosen TCC as partners. It was a really easy selection, Walker says. This week's article of In the Workplace is written by Edward Marshall. Mr. Marshall is the president of the Marshall Group Incorporated in Chapel Hill and author of the business bestseller Building Trust at the Speed of Change. This article is entitled Everyone Needs Their CEO to Be the CCO. Whether your business is large or small, if you are the CEO, you are also the CCO, the Chief Cultural Officer. Culture matters. It is what makes the difference between a thriving, profitable, and growing business and one that is lethargic and struggling. The CCO who takes on the creating, shaping, and development of the company's culture will see a highly productive and happy workforce who produce significant bottom-line results. We've seen pictures of Apple's Steve Jobs, who made the black T-shirt and jeans look famous. That was only a symbol of Apple's culture, not all of its culture. What defines a company's culture? Here are three elements. Identity. The company's history, logo, image, language, location, and the like. Values and principles. Beliefs, core values, and underlying principles. Productive energy. Is it a TGIF culture? Or one where employees take risks, go the extra mile, and collaborate to help the customer? Are they excited to be at work? All things being equal, the company that has a productive energy level of 80%+ will outstrip the competition every time. Company cultures don't just happen. They reflect the personality, leadership, style, values, vision, and preferences of the CEO and their senior leadership. There is a one-to-one correlation between the CEO's beliefs, behaviors, and attitudes and how the workforce behaves. To excel, it is the CEO's job to be the chief cultural officer, which is far more different than handling the financial, product, service, marketing, or customer ends of the business. Here are some things the CEO can do to fulfill this role. 1. Creating. The CCO decides what type of culture the organization is going to have. Command and control, transactional, or collaborative? Will it value transparency? Will it be siloed, matrixed, or flat? Will everyone be engaged? What will the compensation system reward? Individual or team performance? These are only some of the questions. 2. Shaping. The CCO then ensures that the workforce is engaged in understanding and embracing the culture. If the workforce owns the culture, they'll take care of it. The worst kind of culture is the one that emerges from benign neglect. Onboarding employees, focus groups, two-way communication, and regular engagement. All of these tools help shape workforce ownership of the culture. 3. Developing. Cultures are not static. It is the CCO's job to stay on top of the evolution and development of the culture so that it stays true to the original principles and values. Finally, this job can't be delegated. It is exclusively the CEO's role. It is a choice as well. Ignore this role and just let things happen organically, and you will get what you get. Or embrace the role, grow into it, and let the power of the culture work for the workforce and the business. Here's a question for you. Are you paying higher taxes than big businesses? Kent Hoover wants to know. Small businesses organized as S-corporations pay the highest effective tax rates of any businesses in the United States, according to a study conducted by Quantria for the National Federation of Independent Business and the S-Corporation Association. Both of these organizations are part of the Coalition for Fair Effective Tax Rates, which wants Congress to approach tax reform with the goal of treating all businesses similarly, whether they pay corporate taxes or whether their income passes through to their individual owners for tax purposes. The new study found that America's 3.9 million S-corporations pay an effective federal income tax of 31.6%. The profits of S-corporations pass through to individual shareholders for tax purposes. C-corporations, by contrast, are subject to corporate income tax. Although the top corporate income tax rate is 35%, the highest in the developed world, the effective tax rate for America's 814,837 C-corporations is only 17.8%, says the study. Brian Reardon, executive director of the S-Corporation Association, says the high effective tax rates paid by S-corporations are driving capital from these businesses and making them less likely to go out, hire, and invest. This week's People Spotlight is Susan Gordon. She is the CEO of Drug Safety Alliance Incorporated. Drug Safety Alliance Incorporated has tapped pharmaceutical industry veteran Susan Gordon as its new top executive. The announcement comes nearly a year after news surfaced that Irish healthcare services group United Drug PLC was buying DSA and bundling it with other U.S. sales, marketing, and medical companies to make up United Drug's Ashfield Group division. At the time of the acquisition, DSA's then CEO Catherine Crumpton said that the partnership with United Drug would allow DSA to offer its clients a seamless integration of services and help her company gain a more global footprint. Gordon joined DSA in June 2012, just prior to the United Drug deal. She initially served as the company's Senior Vice President of Global Case Processing, overseeing its case management function and helping with new product development. Gordon's role as CEO of DSA will be to lead the overall operations of a company that provides safety and risk management services to a variety of clients. Those clients include pharmaceuticals, biotech, medical device, consumer health, and animal health organizations. Gordon, a registered nurse, reports directly to Marianne Greenberg, a resident regional president of Ashfield, North America. Susan is a natural leader and well-respected in the industry as well as within DSA, said Greenberg in a statement. Joined by a very talented and motivated senior management team, we are highly confident that she will excel in her new role. Durham-based Drug Safety Alliance was founded in 2000 and employs about 100 people, the majority of whom are located in the Triangle. United Drug is a diversified global health care services company specializing in supply chain, packaging, sales, marketing, medical, and regulatory services. The company operates in 5 major international markets and employs more than 7,000 people globally. Gordon was born in Jacksonville and attended UNC Chapel Hill, where she received both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree. Prior to joining DSA, Gordon served as Senior Vice President of Research and Development Operations for King Pharmaceuticals. She focused on providing strategic direction and leadership for project management, clinical operations, and R&D sourcing and procurement for King's Division of Scientific Operations. And prior to her tenure with King, Gordon spent 19 years in positions of increasing responsibility at GlaxoSmithKline after a brief stint in clinical device development at Chatham-Brough Research Group. She holds a bachelor's degree and master's degree in nursing from the University of Chapel Hill, and her primary goal is to make the vision for DSA a reality, which is to be recognized as a worldwide pharma covigilant partner of choice. She is married and has 2 children. This week's opinion editorial page has 2 featured articles, one by Mr. Robert Seligson, the CEO of North Carolina Medical Society in Raleigh, and Shannon B. Dowler, the president of the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. We'll begin with Mr. Seligson's article entitled, Be Careful What You Wish For. Be Careful What You Wish For is our response to your August 2, 2013 article on North Carolina's restrictive laws regarding advanced practice nurses, APN. Not only should patients take a hard look at changing our current statutes, we'd also recommend that the nurses themselves review the practice parameters of their colleagues in less restrictive states where they are unsupervised by physicians. Unfortunately, this article failed to disclose what North Carolina statutes currently mean for the practice of nursing. Instead, the story promoted the popular notion that equates less oversight of APNs with more accessible and cost-effective care. This is not only unproven, it also does not reflect what actually happens day-to-day in clinics and doctor's offices throughout North Carolina under our current statutes. Under North Carolina law, APNs are able to practice to the full extent of their license. In fact, nowhere in the statute or rules is it spelled out what procedures, prescriptions, or referrals a nurse may or may not perform. That determination is left to the nurse and supervising physician based on their respective training and experience. The nurse's scope of practice is framed to an individual collaborative practice agreement between the doctor and the nurse, tailored to that nurse practitioner and physician. The statute and rules only require that they meet periodically to review relevant clinical issues and possible quality improvement measures. The nurse may practice miles away from the supervising physician. No one is breathing down anyone's neck. The law is designed to allow a collaborative agreement to serve the best interests of patients and gives the APN latitude to practice to the top of his or her skills and abilities. The more difficult cases that the nurses claim they would refer to specialists could often be resolved in consultation with their supervising family physician, internist, or pediatrician, and not necessitate the additional copays for sending the patient to a specialist. In states deemed by a nursing association to be less restrictive, doctors may not supervise nurse practitioners, but their scope of practice is often limited by statute. For example, in Maine, the law clearly sets out over many pages of legal language exactly what a nurse practitioner may and may not do. In 2010, May repealed its law that allowed a nurse practitioner to practice beyond the scope set out in statute, even under physician supervision. Nurses in Maine are constrained by the rules set out by lawmakers. The Maine Board of Nursing provides a scope of practice decision tree to help nurses in the state decide whether they are within the law before they are able to treat a patient. and this is in a state deemed less restrictive. Patients, too, should be reassured that the APN who is treating them is in consultation with a doctor whose education far exceeds and has a different focus than that of nurses. As an organization representing doctors and protecting their relationship with patients for 164 years, the North Carolina Medical Society always has supported laws that ensure the highest standards of patient safety. We don't see the need to change the current statutes, since they allow APNs the full range of practice within the safety net of a doctor supporting them. The idea that changing the statute would open opportunities for APNs eager to serve rural North Carolina is misleading. The chart accompanying your article illustrates that nurses cluster in the same areas as doctors, and likely for the same lifestyle considerations, not because of legal prohibitions. The APN's desire to practice independently is also entirely out of step with rapidly emerging models of care that put doctors, nurse practitioners, and other types of providers in close working clinical teams to drive quality improvements and eliminate unnecessary cost. Today, more than 3 million Medicare beneficiaries in 47 states are in these programs, and the results are promising. More to the point, the progress so far underscores the necessity of APNs having more, not less, real-time access to physicians with relevant medical expertise. Across the state, there are countless examples of doctors and APNs serving patients as a collaborative team under the current laws. Changing the statutes may serve to enhance the image of nursing, but in reality, does it truly serve the patient? The next article is by Shannon B. Dowler, president of North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians. Her article is entitled, No Need to Relax NP Standards. Two articles in your August 2nd issue, NC Strict on Nurses and Debate Settles In on Cost versus Quality of Care, highlighted a major health policy in North Carolina, especially as it relates to the delivery of primary care. As president of North Carolina's largest primary care association, the North Carolina Academy of Family Physicians, I want to highlight some extremely significant points the articles fail to present, as well as some insights from a primary care physician's perspective, which was woefully lacking in both pieces. To begin, family physicians unanimously agree that nurse practitioners, NPs, fill an important role in the delivery of care. Today, NPs are considered a key member of patients' health care team. Unfortunately, neither article mentioned how rapidly team-based care is growing and how such care impacts quality, cost, and how providers ultimately practice. Team-based care, through approaches like the patient-centered medical home and now accountable care, is largely reorganizing how primary care and even subspecialty care is delivered. Team-based care is also improving patient satisfaction, achieving better results, and saving money even in the face of managing patients with much more complex and costly chronic diseases. These gains are largely the result of providers, physicians, NPs, subspecialists, and others working together to improve quality. Clinical leadership within this approach requires an extraordinarily high level of training and education. Today, high-quality primary care is not simply diagnostic or clinical, but collaborative and coordinative, which demands a full spectrum of training. A family physician receives 21,700 hours of clinical training and education during 4 years of medical school and 3 years of residency, compared to an average of 5,350 hours of education and clinical training for nurse practitioners. The result is a medical professional who brings breadth and depth to the diagnosis and treatment of all health problems. A primary care physician is trained extensively to make the right diagnosis even when symptoms are not clear. In short, making difficult, unclear diagnoses, managing multiple complex chronic conditions oftentimes requires a level of training that nurse practitioners simply do not possess. Patients understand and care about the difference in training. A recent American Medical Association survey found that 9 in 10 respondents said a physician's years of education and training are vital to the best patient care, especially in emergency and complicated situations, and 3 out of 4 patients said they prefer to be treated by a physician. The articles also failed to give a true picture of our state's regulation of nurse practitioners, which are not nearly as restrictive as one might be led to believe. Nurse practitioners have no regulatory limit on their scope of practice, leaving the breadth of their practice completely up to the agreement between the NP and their supervising physician, which makes joint regulation by the medical board and nursing board critically important. Many other states that are considered less restrictive actually have numerous other limits on care provided by nurse practitioners, including limits on the number of NPs a physician can supervise, limits on on-site versus off-site supervision, and limits on the distance of a supervising physician can be from a nurse practitioner. North Carolina places no such limits on the relationship between an NP and a physician. And, in fact, an NP is only required to meet face-to-face with their supervising physician twice a year. So while family physicians and our state's medical board do take further relaxing these restrictions very, very seriously, and will continue to do so, it is for good reason. Family physicians are committed to our patients' safety, using their health care resources effectively, and improving our health care system for everyone. The solution to improved health care and improved access is not more independent or more fragmented care, but teams of health care professionals working together to improve quality and lower cost. Physicians and NPs are both valued members of the team, but one is simply not a substitute for the other. And finally, Tech Fever brings IPREO to downtown Raleigh. Downtown Raleigh is contagious. Just ask Kevin Marcus, President and Chief Operating Officer of New York Market Intelligence Software Company, IPREO. Ask it for Ed Hat and Citrix came into play in the decision to expand downtown. Yeah, it did, he says. I think we see a bit of boom coming there, really in general for business, but also specifically for technology companies. Marcus expects to create 250 jobs by the end of 2017, and 150 of those will emerge by early 2014. The new facility in the One Bank of America building will open by Labor Day this week, he says. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Please be sure to listen the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.